Okay, I think it's going to... Were you on the plane this morning, were you?
Yep. Yes, I left Atlanta. Well, I got up at 6:30. I was away by 9. Here just in time to have lunch with my publisher and check that they were all still alive there, which is always reassuring for an author.
Atlanta?
Yes. And most of the places I've been signing books. But in Atlanta, I caught lucky. I signed a breast as well. Young lady came into the shop and...
Sure, I should ask you to elaborate on that. But I will.
Well,
explain, please.
Fortunately, I had a nice soft felt tip pen with me, but she came right along and said, would you sign a certain piece of my anatomy? I said, well, if the anatomy's certain I am, I'll go ahead and do it. So she didn't think I'd do it, I suppose. She got a bit shy then. But so one of the guys said, yeah, you can come in the manager's office if you don't want anyone else to see. And Brian will sign a breast for you. When we got there, we took a cameraman in as well. And she got a bit shy then, and I said, oh, come on, darling. I've seen breasts before. Bring it out. It was a really nice breast. I signed around the nipple, Brian W. Aldous. So, I made a promise not to wash it again. Would you like one of these?
No.
It's a good Dutch one.
No, I don't
know. But, yes, that's the first time it's ever happened to me.
Well, yes, that happened in Atlanta.
Yes.
Well, they were more repressed. Down in our southern regions, apparently they're not.
So did I, but apparently not.
That's marvelous.
Mm.
Just to let you know, we can talk, of course, informally, because the little broadcast is stringently edited and worked into a news broadcast.
All right, yeah.
Okay, I'm just...
York, I forget which the hell way to walk, whether to go north or south. So that helps quite a bit.
So when did you arrive in the United States?
I've been just over a week now. I went straight down to Dallas. And,
Dallas?
Yes, Dallas Public Library, which is a fine building and has library space that almost any public library would envy, bought my archives, which consists of about 10,000 books, magazines, letters, old photographs, everything but my old cast-off trousers. They've got it in Dallas Public Library. So I went to unveil the oldest archives.
Is that right?
Mm.
Everything, even all the letters and manuscripts?
Well, not quite all, because the Bodleian Library in Oxford, England, has a certain amount of the stuff. But what they mainly have is manuscripts. What Dallas has is all the books that I used, for instance, when I was writing my history of science fiction. And I've really got a marvelous collection. It's 3 years since I packed it up in boxes, and I hadn't seen it since. It's really strange to see it again in a new context.
So all of your collection?
Yeah.
All of the material that you developed over the years?
Right down to the first copy of Astounding Science Fiction that I bought in September 1939, when the fickle finger of destiny pointed at me and told me that of all the range of pulp magazines that I wanted, it was not Thrilling Ranch Romances or Spicy Zeppelin Stories or G-Man Action, but it was Astounding Science Fiction.
Well, my collection goes back to 1946.
Mm-hmm.
And, but it's not, and it runs from 1946 to about 1953 when I, maybe closer to 1955, I guess, when as I entered college.
Yes.
And also had at that time a complete collection of Galaxy, which was upstart
right.
at the time in the 1950s,
yes.
in fantasy and science fiction.
That's right, yes. Well, that was a great and exciting time when suddenly those two magazines came along as well.
Yes.
Full of good stuff.
Quite a competition.
Yes.
Were there comparable, during that period, were there comparable science fiction magazines in England?
No, not at all. It was hardly known of. I mean, if you'd go into a news store and say, have you got an Astounding? They'd say, an Astounding what? There was a state of ignorance, and for years, as far as I knew, I was the only person who was reading it in England. There were things like H.G. Wells and Jules Verne around, but they weren't the pulp magazines. But they were shipped over as ballast and sold in Woolworths. So I guess someone else really was
you
reading.
Bought them in Woolworths.
Yeah. Bought them in Woolworths. You know, over here, what was it called? The Five and Dime.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in England at that time, it was the threepenny and sixpenny store, and you could buy. There was a big label, Yank Mags, threepence and sixpence. And that's where I first encountered them.
Oh, those are great collector's items.
They are now, yes. They were supposed to be ephemeral, but there were a lot of people around who collected them and saved them.
You know, there are two or three science fiction bookstores here in Manhattan, specializing mm-hmm. only in science fiction. There's a new one, in fact, opened last year called Forbidden Planet.
Yes. Yes, we have one in London also called Forbidden Planet, and very good it is too. In fact, where I was yesterday, I was in Atlanta, Georgia, where there was another new one opened up. Very, very nice shop indeed. So I did some signing there.
I remember my closest high school chum and I were in great competition in collecting science fiction back in the 50s.
Yes.
And I was living in a city called Pittsburgh in Pennsylvania at the time. And, we took the trolley to the Northside Market, where a woman named Olga Snyder had a book stall with a whole bunch of magazines. The first edition of Galaxy had been elusive. Each had collected an entire collection of Galaxy, but we could never find the first.
Yes.
So in going to Olga Snyder's bookstall, I saw a copy of it. Not only did I see a copy of it, I saw two copies of the first issue of Galaxy, and I grabbed them both. So my friend saw me clutching a copy of it. He said, "That's it! That's it! That's the first one! The first one!" I said, "Do you want it?" He said, "Yeah, yeah." I gave it to him, hugged it to his chest. We got back on the trolley. I knew he was thinking, how could my friend been so stupid as to give it up? This precious collector's item, the first edition of Galaxy.
Mm.
He didn't realize that there had been two copies, of course, and I had one for myself, which I still have. He went on to Harvard and donated his, he gave his collection of science fiction quite a few years ago to a public library, and it was appraised at about $300, which doesn't strike me as very much.
Mm.
But many of the books that we collected then were Doubleday Science Fiction Book Club editions, which don't have too much value today.
Mm, yes. Well, it's a good job there was someone around to collect them. I'll tell you about Galaxy, because it's the only time I think I've ever had a dream come immediately true. I woke up one morning and I said to my wife, "Do you know, I dreamt that there was a new magazine out called Galaxy, and that I could get it at a little shop down George Street." And that lunch hour, I went there and it was in the window. It is the most incredible thing. It's never happened to me before or since.
Sure you hadn't passed that shop?
No.
Plants in the window?
No, I hadn't. It wasn't a part of town I went to. And I would think that perhaps I had heard there was a Galaxy, maybe. But there it was. And the most remarkable event. It just shows how obsessed I was with science fiction at the time.
And one of your compatriots in a while back, Douglas Adams.
Oh, yeah.
He says he doesn't like science fiction very well. His books after P.G. Woodhouse.
Well, it certainly sounds as though he's read a certain amount about it, reading those books. It's funny, isn't it, that there are a lot of us who've worked in the field for a long time and have made a living but not a fortune, and this guy comes in and copies all our ideas and makes a fortune. But he does make them very funny, I will say that.
Well, Kurt Vonnegut used to complain that he loved science fiction. His first novel was Player Piano.
That's right.
And he always felt that the science fiction writers were discriminated against. People paid them less than they paid other writers. And he wanted to, although he still has a fantastic, there are fantastic overtones to his work. I don't think people consider him a science fiction writer as such anymore. But he always felt that science fiction should reach a wide body of people and not just a narrow group of, say, adolescents, such as I was when I started reading science fiction.
Yes, yes. Well, I think it is, to an extent, still discriminated against. But, of course, you've got the situation now where the guys that were reading it when they were kids have now got up and made their way in the world, and often they have spread the word. And when I was first interviewed by BBC in London, I always had to explain, first of all, what it was. But now they say, "Oh, come on in, Brian," and they know about it. It's a great relief you don't have to go through those preliminaries anymore.
You're probably a great salesman for science fiction. I mean, signing breasts and things like that.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I'm not into selling breasts.
Well, Douglas Adams says that when he goes on college campuses, he signs towels.
Yes.
There is something in his book, it's like like a crying towel.
Oh, yes.
He uses this towel image in his books, and whenever you go out in space or someplace, you're to take your towel with you. So college students on campus come up to him and have him sign their towels.
He must have a special towel-signing pen, presumably.
I wonder how he gets around the felt, or not the, I guess it's terry cloth, or whatever they call it.
Yes, well, I guess it's one of those big indelible marker things. I suppose it could be done.
There is, your work reminds me to a certain degree, because of its vastness, its depth,
were you going to say Olaf Stapleton?
Isaac Asimov. When I was in the 50s, of course, when I was reading science fiction heavily, he had started writing the Foundation series, Foundation, Foundation and Empire, Second Foundation, and I think he's still a fourth.
That's right. After a long while, Foundation's Edge.
Yes, Foundation's Edge. Uh-huh. And, but he created a universe that spanned hundreds of years and many globes. And,
yes.
And he tied everything together. It's been many years since I've read him.
Mm-hmm.
He tied things together so well. Characters who had an impact eons before would somehow reemerge.
That's right. The great Harry Seldon, who reappeared at moments of crisis. Well, I didn't say that was one of my models, but since I've read just about everything that's been written in the science fiction field, or at least up to 1970 when I did my history, they are all there in the compost heap of the mind. But I suppose my real model was Olaf Stapleton. I had great admiration, I still have, for his writing. And I did want to do a very large novel. By the time the Heliconia trilogy, as everyone calls it, is complete, I think they'll see that it is actually one novel in three volumes. There are very close linkages between the volumes, which I think the third one will reveal.
I think it would be interesting for you to tell the listeners about the Heliconia and what it is, and who the people are, and what you have done. Can you do that for us?
It's very difficult to do, you know. But let's
better you than me.
Well, maybe that's so. Let's start with the easy one. You see, okay, they're going to be three. There's Heliconia Spring, Heliconia Summer out already, and I've got the third one, Heliconia Winter, in the pipeline. And when I presented these to my English publisher, he was very thrilled with them, and he said, "They're fascinating, Brian, but what sort of blurb are we going to put on them? What are they, in a nutshell, what are they really about?" And I said, "Well, you know, Tom, they're about a change in the weather." And basically they are, because Heliconia is a planet that has a year equivalent to 2,500 Earth years. So it has a long elliptical orbit, and in that great year, as it's called, it undergoes the equivalent to 5 centuries of winter and 4 centuries of summer, and then long spaces of spring and fall in between. And that was something I'd really wanted to do for a long time. Since the Heliconia itself is a planet with a binary sun, this immediately suggested to me, well, the divided nature of mankind, the binary within us, the good and the bad, the superego and the id, and all kinds of metaphors like this. So I wanted to use that. And, of course, one way I do is to invent an alien species. There are humans, but there are also the Fagors. And the Fagors are the guys you love to hate. And the Earthmen really want to wipe them out. But the Earthmen themselves, just like people on Earth, can never quite get it together enough to do it at the time when they have power, because the Fagors are very powerful in the winter but weak in the summer. But the human nations on Heliconia spend most of the summer warring with each other, just the way we do it on Earth. So that if they do actually wipe out the Fagors, they'll be in trouble, because there is a helicovirus which is transmitted from Fagors to human beings, which makes them undergo a metamorphosis in the spring and the fall, because the changes of climate are so great that when it's hot, you want a tall, thin-bodied man, because he loses most heat that way. It's like the very tall Negroes in Africa. They're constructed so they can endure the intense heat. Whereas with the cold, you have The Eskimos are the obvious example. They're short, round people, because with that configuration you lose least heat. So this is when the virus attacks at the two times of the year, it actually changes the human metabolism slightly. But the humans to begin with don't know that. So they're in a catch-22 position. They want to wipe out the Fagos, and life would be better for them if they did wipe out the Fagos. On the other hand, it'd probably kill them off too. So this is the dilemma in the books. Well, it's one of many dilemmas in the book.
The books, are they published simultaneously in both the United States and England?
That's why they're so cheap, because they're done that way. The copy editing and the printing is done over here by Athenaeum, and they ship back the matrixes to England, and the English edition is printed straight from those matrixes. So there's absolutely no difference in the text.
What about the covers? Beautiful artwork.
Oh, they're very nice indeed. Well, the first one, everyone liked. And in all the foreign translations, it's doing very well in Europe, in Germany and France. Everyone went for that first cover. It's a beautiful cover. No one argued about that cover. Well, the second one, we had more difficulty. And Kate wanted a wraparound. That is not a wraparound. So that the English edition has a different cover. But I think that looks lovely, and Athenaeum have brought it up well. I think it's a beauty. And I've been to see my publisher this afternoon, and we're worrying about what we do for the third one.
Do you find it difficult to attract a readership out of the traditional science fiction buff?
Well, I don't in England, because we never had the pulps, which divided up fiction into so many subcategories. We've never had that, so there's not that division in the public mind. And also, I've written a lot of other books, mainly, I suppose, about English life, which have not done so well over here, but have been bestsellers in England. So that there, they just see me as a writer. So I don't have the hang-up about being labelled as a science fiction writer. And my publisher doesn't either. That's one of the nice things about Athenaeum. They don't seem to mind either. They just sell it. And in fact, when I began it, I felt that there were a lot of qualities in there that made it something apart from science fiction. So I went back to the old terms that H.G. Wells always used with his early books and called it a scientific romance.
Scientific romance?
Yeah. Where perhaps it's a distinction without a difference, but... I think there is a difference.
Are you living in London?
No, I live in Oxford. This is one of the advantages of living in Oxford, that I got a lot of advice on those books. I wanted to get the background right.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it's full of learned men who are just longing to tell you all they know about archaeology or history or cosmology or whatever.
Scientific.
So you knock on any door, as they say.
How do you, as you start to write a project which is as immense as this, you talk about three books, which will actually be three editions of a single work.
Yeah.
How do you do it? Have you plotted well out to the future? Do you sit there and do it as you go, or how does it work in your mind?
Well, you really do both. That's the honest answer. Although it sounds a silly one, when you begin with, you have it's kind of like having to drive to somewhere that you don't know. First of all, you want to look at a map and get the route kind of fixed in your mind, such that you know that you're going to have to drive northwest or whatever the direction is. But perhaps on the way you see a lot of little byroads that look more attractive. It's rather like that. I did know where I was going to get to, and eventually I'll get to there, but what surprised me is the way I got there. Does that make sense to you? You see, the whole thing will have taken me 9 years by the time I finished it. I spent three just doing the research, and my wife kept saying to me...
I'm sorry.
Okay, my wife kept saying to me, you know, what about the bread and butter? And so eventually I got down to writing it. Then it is really a matter of putting the knowledge in the background and just telling a story that you hope will interest your readers. And I'm one of these lucky people that I can sit down in the morning and suddenly see exactly what the next scene must be. So it keeps me interested too. This is a great thing. If I'm kept interested, over that long span, the chances the readers might be.
But you're using some writing aids for yourself. For example, in your new book, you have a map of Heliconia that you... was that your map? Did you draw that?
No, my wife drew that. But we'd already had a geologist figure out exactly what the place looked like and what was going on there, so it was a matter of transcribing that and making a simpler version. But you need it in the second book. In the first one, you don't. You don't quite know where you are, and that's the way it should be, because gradually the characters of Heliconia, as culture develops, they become better oriented.
I see you have one. What is the science fiction award that
you've won? Oh, that won the John W. Campbell Memorial Award, which I was very pleased with indeed.
The Nebula?
No, I didn't win the Nebula. It got pipped at the post by a novel by Michael Bishop. It was in the finals, but it didn't win the Nebula. A publisher is not on oath.
A Nebula Award, 1965, from the Saliva Tree.
Oh, for the Saliva Tree, sorry. Yep, I've won Hugo's and Nebula's, but as yet not for Heliconia.
Oh.
I've still got one to go.
Oh, well, you're
so still
to win the Nebula.
Well, we'll see, we'll see.
You're not out of the running yet.
No?
Do you consort, if that's the word, with other science fiction writers?
Yes, I know a lot of them. Yes, many of them are close friends of mine. But we are not as close a body in the UK as we are over here. And one of the things I like coming over to the States is meeting a whole lot of writers that I didn't know. Mm-hmm. That's very pleasant.
How often do you get to the United States?
I come over here every spring, and I always have a call to make in Florida. I go down to a thing called the Conference of the Fantastic. Now, first of all, Florida is very nice in March. It's not too hot. And also, the weather in England is generally boring in March, so it's a good time to come.
In Dallas is now the home of Richard Condon, who I don't think he's written science fiction as such. He may have dabbled in it a little bit.
Some of them quite like science fiction.
But he'd lived in England for quite a while, and in Scotland as well.
Ireland. He was over in Ireland. That's right. Yes.
But he decided to make his home in Dallas.
I didn't know that.
Yes, he had told me that one of the reasons, well, the chief reason he'd gone to Dallas from Ireland was that his daughter lives in Dallas, but also because you had mentioned the library there, he thought that the library facilities were magnificent and he could do almost any kind of research that he needed for his books.
Mm-hmm.
Also, he said he got a little dull. He was out in Ireland and out in the country, and about the only person he could see was the Guinness man about once a week. So he felt it was time to come to the United States and get back into the action.
Yes. Well, the attraction about Ireland for a writer is that they leave you alone and don't tax you.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. So many writers, well, Dick Francis, for example, spends half of the time in Fort Lauderdale. And yes. Why isn't it you haven't fled to avoid this high taxation in England?
I asked myself that, and one reason why there's an oldest archive in Dallas Public Library is because I got caught for a heap of tax, and I had to pay it up. And to pay it up, I had to sell my big house I had with a swimming pool and everything, and I had to buy a house that had two rooms less, so I couldn't hold all my science fiction library. So I got rid of it. But I don't know. I mean, I'd quite like to live in the States, but I wouldn't know where to live. I'd quite like to live in Italy, but I wouldn't know where to live. Also, I don't speak Italian. I don't even speak American, but I can make myself understood over here, which is something.
There's only one place to live in the United States.
Don't tell me, let me guess.
Well,
I've got lots of friends here.
It was certainly nice talking to you. I'm delighted. I think I said before, you must be a terrific salesman for science fiction, because you're certainly a delight to talk to you. Incidentally, are you folks in England still somewhat irritated with Paul Theroux?
Oh, no, I don't think so.
He said he'd gotten savage. His book made the bestseller list in England, as The Kingdom by the Sea, which dissected the British quite well, but he said he got savage reviews.
Well, he got some savage reviews, but he got some very enthusiastic reviews. For the sake of drama, he perhaps didn't mention those. But, you know, so often writers really can't have it both ways. They either get on the bestseller list or they get all the good reviews. But of course we all want it both ways.